Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Thank you all for coming and welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival. My name is Eric Jensen. I'm the founding editor of the Saturday Paper and editor-in-chief of Schwartz Media. Thank you. I want to start by acknowledging that we meet today on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respect to elders, past and present, and other Indigenous people who may be in the room. I want also to say that the land we're meeting on was stolen, that it was taken by war and legal fiction, and that the violence of colonisation is ongoing, is built into all of the systems of our country, and will continue to damage people until we have the strength as a nation to confront it. I should add that there is a roadmap in front of the Parliament called the Uluru Statement of the Heart that would go some way towards beginning those processes, and it's been ignored by two prime ministers and is up to people like us in rooms like this to demand that the Parliament act. This session is called The War in Newsrooms, which is a change for me because for the past 10 years or so, I've been invited to writers' festivals to talk about the ways in which the world is destroying journalism, and it's nice to come into a room and blame other journalists for a change. And I mean that quite genuinely. I think as an industry that loves to talk about itself, journalism is uniquely bad at contemplating its own responsibilities for the state of its craft. So conversations like this are the ones we should be having. All right, to introduce us. As I say, I'm Eric Jensen. I'm the editor-in-chief at Schwartz Media. I'm a journalist and biographer and screenwriter. And my most recent book is a collection of poetry called I Said the Sea Was Folded, which is out this week. Immediately beside me is Alan Sunderland, a former editorial director at the ABC, a broadcast journalist at both the ABC and the SBS, with several decades of experience at each.
Dozens of them.
He's won two Walkley Awards. He is now the executive director of the Organisation of News Ombudsmen, an international project to set standards within newsrooms. Beside him, Osman Faruqi, who works with me at Schwartz Media as the editor of our daily news podcast, 7am. He's worked before that as an editor at the ABC and is currently writing a book on race in Australia, which will be published by Penguin Random House, and which I'm sure we're all looking forward to reading. I'm sure you're looking forward to finishing.
My publisher is very keen to read it.
And Ariel Bogle is an analyst with ASPE's International Cyber Policy Centre, where she researches online influence and disinformation. She's been a technology reporter at the ABC and a technology editor at The Conversation and an associate editor with Future Tense. Her reporting has been published in The New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and Slate. Thank you, welcome. Now, there is, and this session is about, a great fight that is happening in newsrooms at the moment. A fight between the past and the future, young and old, between whiteness and diversity, and about objectivity and purpose. I'm not going to give a great preamble to this session because I think a lot of this conversation hinges on definitions and perceptions, and I think it's important that we establish those together as a panel instead of working from anything that's prescribed. But Oz, I was going to start with you and ask if you could begin by describing what you think are the major fault lines in newsrooms at the moment, where this war is being fought.
Sure. It's very funny actually to be on this particular panel talking about this because I've worked with everyone here in different capacities and have probably fought with them all at different points as well. I think it's a really good question to start on because what I see as the fault lines in newsrooms are really the fault lines across society at the moment, but I think they're reflected in news organizations perhaps more intensely, because journalists and editors are kind of by their nature seeking out to find where society is going, what are the questions that need to be asked and answered. And at the same time, newsrooms and media organizations, like so many legacy institutions, reflect the problems of society. So when I'm talking about those fault lines, I'm talking about things like diversity and justice when it comes to issues like gender and race. It questions about who holds power in society. And I think all of those questions, whichever way you want to, which kind of components you want to focus on, are reflected in news organizations as well. But I think that what sits above that is what you alluded to before, this question of what is the purpose of news in the age that we live in. I think the two things are tied, because I think when news organizations first started, when newspapers were in their heyday, the purpose of news is different to, I think, what audiences want or expect from it now. And I think newsrooms are battling every day to figure out what their role is. Is their role to share all perspectives widely, regardless of the content of them or how offensive they might be to some people? Is their view to use their platform and their resources to shape opinion in a particular direction? Is it their role to elevate certain voices that are missed from the conversation? Or is it to just publish things in a way that is seen as objective as possible, though I think we're going to unpack that a bit later on as well. So I think I see those two tracks as being the big fault lines.
And Ariel, do you see these as simply questions that are being asked in newsrooms, or are these actual conflicts that are going on in newsrooms? Are these things where there is a real fight over the answer to these questions, not simply a curiosity about posing them?
No, I do think there's a fight about them to some degree. Even if we don't even look at who's in the story, but what stories get covered full stop and who's allowed to report them. I've reflected before that in this sort of journey, who is a journalist? We really love it when ex-soldiers become journalists. We love it when doctors become journalists. But if you have other kinds of personal experience that might reflect on your reporting, there's more qualms about it in the newsroom, I've found, even here in Australia. So it is an active battle, but I'm not sure that it's one that is like, I'm not talking about like down and out fights in the newsroom, like battles over and fights on the news desk about what stories get covered, but it's more like a sort of institutional pressure to cover every new press release that the government puts out, but not question where the stories are coming from the community level. So it's a balance between the two, but it is a fight and an institutional issue at the same time.
And Alan, has this question always been there about what experience and what kind of personal baggage a reporter brings to the stories that they're covering? Has that always been an issue in journalism, or is it a new issue? Was it previously thought that all journalists were just inherently kind of neutral, free of any?
I think what we're seeing now is the great reckoning in journalism. The fundamental issue has always been there. Let's go back to the basics. You're the community we're trying to serve. And the notion has always been in the heart of modern journalism, and people argue about how old it is, that you set aside your own worldview, you set aside your prejudices, you are there as a seeker of truth, you weigh up the facts, you find out what's going on, and you share that information with the community as dispassionately and impartially as you can. That's always been the gold standard of the best journalism. What I think journalism failed to take account of is that this so-called paragon of virtue, which I fundamentally support and believe works, was largely the domain of the middle-class white male who filled all of our newsrooms. And that might have made sense when that reflected to a greater or lesser extent, I suspect it never did, the Australian community were there to serve. Over time, of course, diversity, multiculturalism, it's changed the nature of the country. We've become more sophisticated about understanding who we are and who we represent. And people have increasingly started to call out the fact that this so-called impartiality actually is at risk of imposing a very conservative, very predictable worldview, even as it's pretending and claiming not to. So when I say the great reckoning, I think journalists and newsrooms everywhere, as they begin to be populated by more and more diverse people, tough questions are being asked. And the challenge for me, what I'm here to talk about today, is the challenge of maintaining what I consider to be an important principle against what has been in the past some fairly sloppy practice and some fairly large blind spots.
What do you mean by sloppy practice there? And what is the principle that's defended?
Okay, so let's take one of the most abused and awful practices in journalism, this notion of balance. Okay, so if I have 50% of the people in my story who say that climate change exists and 50% who say it doesn't, then I've done my job, I'm not imposing a worldview, and I've achieved balance and I can just relax. That is not only lazy, it's misleading and it's wrong. So what you need to do as a journalist is say, I'm making editorial judgments. I'm setting aside my own prejudices as well as those of everyone else, and I'm being led by the facts, by the evidence. So at the ABC, where I worked for many years, we talked about balance that follows the weight of evidence. So a lot of the kind of lazy journalism of the past said, look, I'll just tick all the boxes, and I know who the approved voices are, that's the mainstream, and I won't include radical idiot voices, and I've got my job done. And I think increasingly journalists are being challenged. And the only thing that worries me, it's where Osman and I have disagreed in the past, is about what that means for the principle of impartiality and objectivity, whether it actually is a valid process at all. People say, we're all subjective, we all have our own views. Do we still cling on to that and find the kernel of that good behaviour, even as we acknowledge that the execution of it has been lacking at times in the past?
Yeah, I mean, do you mind, Eric?
Please.
I think Alan referenced the fact that we've disagreed on some of these things, but I want to caveat and say that any stories or things that I say, and obviously not personally directed at Alan, who I have a great relationship with, so I like to think. But I think objectivity and impartiality are important things that all journalists should strive for. And I think they are, as you describe them, processes rather than states of being, right? But I also think that so often they've been used as a way to undermine those terms, and the way that they're practiced have been used as a way to undermine the voices and perspectives of those who don't fit the archetype that you were describing of the middle-class white man. And I give an example of that. After the horrific massacre at Christchurch a couple of years ago, I raised in a few different organizations that I worked in and was associated with how much of a missed opportunity it was from a news perspective to not send anyone from Australia to cover that who had either a Muslim background or spoke a community language that the family of survivors and victims of that horrific attack had, that they could speak in their language essentially. And my sort of argument for that wasn't just it's the right thing to do and we should reflect diversity. It was purely from a news perspective. You're going to get a better story. You're going to get a more empathetic and deep story if people can speak in the language to the survivors, if they've been in a mosque before and understand how to tell that. And the response that I was given by one particular very senior editor in charge of foreign affairs coverage said, well, we couldn't send a Muslim journalist there because they have a subjective view on this issue. They have a biased view on the issue of this attack. They have skin in the game, essentially. And I found that a very fascinating and revealing comment because it assumes that there's a neutrality, which is the middle-class white man, and everyone else brings a different perspective. My response was, this is a white supremacist attack. You're a white person who benefits from the structures and powers of white supremacy. You have skin in the game, and so does every other white journalist reporting that story. And I think part of this battle that we're seeing is about smashing what neutrality and objectivity is. And I think it's not a clear thing. It never has been a clear thing. And I think we actually are seeing that shift in some spaces now. I think the reporting over the past few months in Canberra, I don't think would have happened 10 or 20 years ago. And I think it's happened because the press gallery, for all its other issues with diversity, has more women, not just in journalist roles, but in senior editor roles and management roles. And those people are saying, you guys 20 years ago might not have thought that this was a story worth reporting, but we think it is. And we think it deserves a lot of time and attention. And I think that's showing how you can still report things with impartiality and follow that process objectively. But your emphasis and perspective just does change because all of us as human beings, what we think is important is shaped by our values and who we are and our own experiences. And I think ultimately when newsrooms do become ideally more reflective of the wider community, we'll start to see those emphasis change in other directions as well.
And just to jump on that too, Amit, it's also about who the newsroom and who the community at large thinks can practice impartiality and objectivity in that sort of situation. Osman is describing there, it was presumed that a Muslim person or a person that spoke the languages of the Christchurch survivors and their families was too close to the subject to be able to practice the hallowed notion of objectivity. And I think too of a situation that played out at the Washington Post recently with a journalist called Felicia Sonmez. She was a reporter, a very respected practice reporter, who had gone public about a sexual assault that she alleged had happened to her when she'd been a correspondent in China. It was a big story at the time. A few years later, this is a bit roundabout, but Kobe Bryant, the famous basketball player, died in a horrific accident. She, in the sort of aftermath of that, tweeted an old article about a rape allegation against him. And the backlash to her bringing that story up at that time became this like huge thing on Twitter. She was abused. She actually had to leave her house because of threats. And instead of backing her up, the Washington Post actually banned her from covering any stories to do with sexual assault. So it was both a fear, it seems like, from that newsroom about the kind of trolling and online abuse she would face and the sort of vitriol aimed at the newsroom, but also it was presumed, it seems, that she could no longer practice objective reporting about allegations of sexual assault because she'd been through a personal experience and then been involved in a kind of online car crash of its own about sexual assault. So it was presumed that this woman could no longer practice objectivity about certain stories. It meant she couldn't cover the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, all kinds of major stories in Washington. So this is just to follow that. Who can practice objectivity?
And in both those cases, what the editors are worried about is an excess of sympathy. There's a belief that somehow our craft as journalists can't be practiced from a sympathetic place, as if sympathy undermines what we do. And I find it a really strange thing that we idolize the notion of the kind of amoral journalist, the journalist who, despite seeing the horrors of what they're meant to be covering, is unmoved by them and simply reports them. And I think it asks a really interesting question about where the engine of journalism comes from, why we are journalists, and what makes us good journalists. And I wonder, Alan, you probably have maybe a slightly more traditional or conventional view than...
Old-fashioned, you mean?
I was looking for a word that was as neutral as my reporting.
Of course. But I don't mind a bit of emotional reporting, Eric, so you go for it.
But was that the view, that somehow... Part of this, we need to get back to actually defining objectivity and to defining impartiality, because my view is actually that a disclosure about the journalist's baggage within a story produces a good story, and that all of us have that baggage, and to pretend that we can somehow close it off is to pretend that we are somehow non-human. But to this question of, like, what is it that we used to... that journalism traditionally thought journalists should do. Why was sympathy thought of as
problematic? There's a lot tied up in that. Let me unpack a few strands, because I partly agree with you and partly disagree. I think we've identified something really important here that I don't want to diminish, and that is this notion that some people are objective and some people carry biases, and the mainstream middle of the road, usually male, usually white, is neutral, and everyone else has these weird biases. They've got, you know, they're women, they're, you know, come from an indigenous... that's obviously a nonsense, okay? And I think one of the great things about the kind of the reckoning we're having now is that understanding that we all inevitably carry around a whole baggage of blind spots and prejudices and life experience that can both help and hinder. And that goes back to the question of sympathy. The great fear that traditional journalism has had about, you know, sympathising is that you lose the ability to make the tough judgments you need to make in a story. You identify too closely with someone, and therefore you're not giving it that level of scrutiny that as a community we need. How do we assess these claims? Do we believe all women instinctively all the time? Do we ask difficult questions? That's part of that tradition of understanding that difference. I've never been a believer that transparency of your own baggage is better than impartiality, because impartiality is a myth. Of course none of us are impartial. Of course we're all subjective. But if you understand that objectivity or impartiality is not a state of mind like sainthood, it is a discipline that you practice. It's a thing that you do, right? Everybody can do it. And what you do is, you're going out into the world to experience something. The first thing you do, in my guidance that I wrote for the ABC, I said, when you're practicing impartiality, you have tough questions to ask. The first tough questions you have to ask are of yourself. What is my blind spots? What am I bringing to this story? I'm a father. I'm a husband. I send my kids to a public school or private school. I travel to work by car. Whatever story you're doing, you'll have your own set of prejudices. Your first job is to try and be aware of those, and then to try as best you can to set them aside, to look at things from different perspectives, to understand. And then there's nothing wrong with telling a story with passion, with energy. There's absolutely nothing wrong with openly declaring your prejudices, if you like, but that never should preclude you from the journalistic request that you try to separate and think beyond them. And we're all capable of it. We ask our judges and our police and our lawyers and our school teachers to do it and try and set aside any prejudice they have and treat us all equally. No reason why we can't ask that of journalists. It's just about the assumptions behind the process. And I fear that in identifying the kind of bad practices, we'll throw the baby out with the bathwater.
It's really interesting. I mean, again, I feel like maybe we're all too nice because I agree and disagree and we'll be very sure. polite about it. I think before I come back to some of the things you raised, to your question, Eric, about the engine of journalism, I think Alan sort of described one potential sort of motivation, which is helping explain the world to the community, to the audience. I think that is obviously a huge component of what journalism is, and I don't think that journalism should stop doing that. But I mean, I have a slightly different perspective on it as well. And in some ways, I think it's even more traditional, and perhaps we've lost it, and now we're trying to get it back. And it's about holding power to account. I think that can be perceived as being political, but to me, it's the very fundamental nature of, I think, what animates journalism, which is that the world, yeah, we need to explain how the world works. Once you go to the next step, you're like, everything in the world, and I'm not even just talking about politics, whether it's business or anything, is a set of power relations. There are people like us who are regular people that make our way around the world, and there are people who make decisions and vote on things and invest in certain things that change the future of our lives, right? And as journalists, we have the privilege and the platform and the resources to interrogate things. And to me, we should be using those very specifically to interrogate power. And I think by making the decision to do that, you kind of are taking a side in a way. But I think it's a good side to take. And in the way that that manifests, I think, for example, and again, I'm not at all saying that Alan's suggesting this, but when it comes to reporting things like sexual assault or racism, I'm very happy to be on the side of it's bad when powerful people do bad things to less powerful people. And my reporting is going to take that perspective. There may be some people that see me as, you know, and there are certain journalists that don't take that approach. We've seen that with the reporting around Christian Porter and the allegations against him that he denies, that people, some people thought it should be written and reported on from the perspective of a power imbalance. And some people thought, well, no, there's too many complexities around this. We need to give more scope to kind of push back against the narrative that was developing at the time. So I think it's a slightly different conception of journalism to just explaining the world, but I think it's one that I find more compelling in terms
and
of what I do.
Ariel, part of this, doubt is a necessary tool of our craft. Doubt is also an instrument of silence. Doubt prevents stories being told that might be difficult to tell. How do we balance those things?
Question, just to come back to what Alan was saying as well, like I'm not 100% sure that the notion of impartiality is under threat. I don't think, if we're talking about this, you know, quote unquote generational warfare, I'm not sure that the younger generation is trying to do away with impartiality or we no longer learn it at J school. You know, it's more the fight is that what we were talking about before, who gets to tell the story and what stories get told at all, because some of the debate around the recent reporting from Canberra seems to be more about should that story have been told at all, not so much the way it was told. I mean, in Australia, I think we sometimes think we're fighting about how stories get told because of the overwhelming nature of our defamation laws, but I'm not sure that we are truly fighting about the notion of impartiality. I think most journalists would agree you want to interrogate, confront both sides, fact check, make sure you're balanced without waiting away from fact. But are we really fighting about impartiality, or are we just fighting about who can tell the stories and which stories get told?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And there's no doubt that that is a valid part of it. I guess I've had a lot of exposure to the academic literature, and there's been a particular strand in journalism, academic journalism, for some time now that says the view from nowhere, you know, both sidesism is a terrible thing. I agree. I just don't think that's what objective journalism is. It's when it's done badly. I think the other pressure you get, and we dealt with a lot of this in our time at the ABC, was about the ABC is there funded by all Australians, and so we say we'll look at everything impartially, but we do have a fundamental commitment to freedom of speech and democracy. And there was a lot of push. For example, there were people at the ABC who said we should not have covered the same-sex marriage debate as if there were two legitimate sides to that debate. There was only one legitimate side to that debate, which was about human rights and respect for fellow Australians and what they wanted to do, and there was no other legitimate side. And I guess my concern, and they were some of the real debates we had, and a lot of them were generational debates, was how you ensure that you can still take an approach that says, look, whether we like it or not, there are views, you don't have to take the side of a particular fundamental religious perspective, but there are legitimate views that need to be dealt with as objectively as possible and presented back into the community about how that debate goes. So they kind of overlap in a way, and I think I want to stress that most of this, the discussions that Oz and I had at the ABC were really healthy, constructive ones, because two different experiences coming together, trying to work through what it means to be a journalist. And the beauty of that is that that conversation wouldn't have happened because there wouldn't have been that many Osmonds in the newsroom a generation ago. We're now seeing these pressure points. When the ABC did the Charlie Hebdo stories, we had enormous pushback when we published one of the cartoons from our own Muslim and Islamic staff within the ABC writing to us saying, why are you doing this? We find it deeply offensive. We had to work our way through that. And so in the midst of all of that, I just fear sometimes that I guess where I draw the line is I want a newsroom that is as diverse as it possibly can be, socioeconomically, ethnically, gender, all of those things. But I then want that journal, that collective newsroom, to rub up against each other, to eliminate each other's blind spots, and to produce the kind of classic impartiality that I think powers the best journalism.
Do you think, Oz, that we're having these conversations, though, because newsrooms that are becoming ever so slightly more diverse, partly because 10 years ago they sacked all of their older reporters and have had to hire younger ones, ever so slightly different. We're having these conversations not necessarily along the lines that you're talking about them, Alan, but because senior people in those newsrooms are offended by change within the industry, offended by change among their colleagues, dismissive of experience that is being brought to those newsrooms.
I think that's exactly right. I think the other thing is the change that we're starting to see isn't happening out of some sort of sense of the people in power waking up one day and deciding that, it's time to now let these people in. People like myself and people from other marginalized groups have kicked down the doors to be let in, and there's still nowhere near enough of us that should be there. And I think this is what I was alluding to at the start of the conversation, is it's not just in newsrooms, it's a societal conversation. There's obviously people who have always been in charge and have had power are scared of losing that power. And I think in newsrooms it manifests in these conversations, I think, that we're having now. And I think the change, the example Alan's giving about the way that when you have more diversity that forces you to deal with issues, I think is actually the right way to think about it, because often these resolutions are made because vocal groups of staff who have been underrepresented have organized and fought for it. And I think, you know, when Eric made the comment, which is sort of pithy but also exactly right, a class of senior reporters has exited the industry, but the new people that are coming through that come from more diverse backgrounds tend to be much lower paid, tend to be in much more junior positions, tend to be precariously employed on contracts. So they might physically be there, but they don't have the same power.
To be clear, that top layer is still exactly what it was.
Yeah.
The people that run the newsrooms, the managing editors, the editorial directors.
When you say the newsrooms were hollowed out, we mean the crust of...
We mean the filling.
Yeah, the crust is all still there.
Yeah.
It's like an empty pie.
Yes.
I just wanted to pick up on a thing Alan was talking about the same-sex marriage plebiscite. I think it's a really fascinating question that I kind of still grapple with in terms of if I was hypothetically in charge of the ABC, what would be the approach to take there? I mean, obviously, the plebiscite was a huge national issue and it needed to be reported, and there was definitely a no case, right? But I also... I found it very difficult to think, well, if this was a referendum on racial intermarriage laws, for example, if this was a referendum on should we ban Muslims from coming to Australia, was this a referendum on should we send all people from China to Christmas Island during the pandemic? Ideas that are so fundamentally heinous that impact all of us, just because there's a political push for it, does it by virtue mean that we as journalists need to give it the respect and deference that we might in other situations? And I don't think we would. And I actually think you talked about climate change before. Like, there are already issues that the ABC, even the ABC, which is, like, I think the best at doing this sort of stuff, has deemed to be, we're not going to interview climate deniers. We're not going to have someone on our show who says that domestic violence is an important way for a man to unwind and get out of stresses, but we do interview people who want to kill Muslims. We do, in the case of the same-sex plebiscite, give an equal uncontextualized perspective to people who think that your sexuality means you can't get married. And I think that reflects, like, the reason why we've made those decisions on things like climate change and violence against women is because newsrooms reflect, those issues reflect the concerns of newsrooms. And I think if we got to a point where newsrooms looked like the country, then we would be making the same judgments about those issues.
And I guess my response to that would be that when a community is having a debate, we need to fairly represent and present that debate as best we can. Now, I don't think we need to be deferential. And I guess the difference I would make, let's take climate change. The ABC has I dealt with the complaints handling unit. Whenever we got a complaint about why on earth we had Tim Flannery on or why we talked about climate change as if it was real, I would send a response out that said the vast consensus, scientific consensus of understanding, this was 10 years ago, of climate change is that it is real and that it exists. There is a debate about what the best policy response to it is and how quickly we should move, but the facts are clear and we are not going to entertain a debate over factual matters. The facts, you know, you all get your own opinion, you don't get your own set of facts. And I think when it comes to same-sex marriage, and I think it was covered both good, bad and indifferently throughout, is that you want to get to the stage where you debunk the myths, you don't give oxygen to factually incorrect claims about what's being put, what's being argued. But where there are differences of opinion that are real, where we are having a debate, we're not having a debate at the moment about whether it's good for people of other sexes to marry, of other ethnic backgrounds to marry. If, heaven help us, we're at a situation where we had that debate, then the ABC would need to be finding a way of covering that. Currently, as I understand it, every time they poll the Australian population, we still have a majority of Australians who are in favour of capital punishment. There is no live active debate about that. One day there may be. And when that day comes, the ABC and responsible media would need to find a way of saying, how do we have that debate and tease out the arguments that are reflected in the people we're reporting to, so that we can have that covered as fairly as possible and not say, well, the ABC has decided that we have a particular view and we're going to use that to filter what we report.
At the same time, obviously, in the coverage of the postal vote, the ABC put to air appalling views that they wouldn't have wished to put to air because of the nature of live interviews. And that's a sort of a separate conversation.
But there's a lot of issues around the execution of these things.
Yeah, exactly. Errol, I want to come back to you, and we will go to questions soon after this, but how does audience change this as well? And especially thinking about the work that you've done with the internet, with misinformation, with the way in which journalism may have one intent and then be used another way. Part of this reckoning that is going on with newsrooms, is it shaped by the understanding that the material we produce actually now has a kind of higher responsibility than it might once have because of how it can be filtered and misused?
Yeah, definitely. I think there is another sort of maybe a generational or a cultural difference in some newsrooms is a naivety on the part of some people in charge about what there's the long life, the long tail of content now. So I'm thinking about coverage, say, of vaccination. So a headline now that you put on a story, say there has been, somebody has been vaccinated and they have cramps in their leg. The headline that says somebody, says man vaccinated develops life-ending cramps. When you read the story, you'll read, okay, it happened, there's a correlation, not necessarily causation, health department investigates, yada, yada. But the headline alone is enough to do the damage because the headline is enough to generate fear. It'll immediately be screenshotted, and I've seen this countless times, then filters through into anti-vaccination Facebook groups, Instagram pages, has a long, long tail. And there is both a naivety about that long tail and also sometimes on the part of some outlets, a deliberate exploitation of those groups. So I think too about the endless polls that happen on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook from some news outlets in Australia, mostly morning television of various descriptions. They keep doing these polls on Instagram, which are, say, will you fly Qantas if they require you to be vaccinated before, you know, proof of vaccination? Those polls, I see them, they turn up on the Instagram account of the TV show. I immediately see them in the anti-vaccination Telegram groups where they encourage their followers to sort of swarm back on the Instagram page to vote no, 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 and to, you know, yell at Qantas, etc. So there's a sort of naivety and a lack of internet fluency sometimes on the part of people who are in charge. And often I have to be honest in the part of, I've worked with fabulous editors that are very interested in the internet, but sometimes an active disinterest and a kind of snobbery about social media and internet fluency in general. So a lot of times people who are in decision-making positions may not even be on these social platforms and understand how they work, and yet they are making decisions that will flow through these networks. So that's another ongoing issue, I think, and another sort of sidebar of this generational shift in newsrooms as well.
And Oz, what does that do for the responsibility around coverage of things like race, which I think is the underlying issue of some of what we're talking about when we come to this impartiality question?
I mean, yeah, I think it's good to be specific, because I feel like when these tensions, at least in my experience, have erupted, it's often on reporting these issues. And I think Ariel's so right. I think there's another component to this that's really important, which is generational differences change, like you have a different understanding of what a story does, how a story travels, and the impact it has. And I think there's a really great concrete example of this, which is the way that most of the Australian media reports on far-right activists or actors or far-right extremists. And there's a sense of, well, journalism can interrogate these people. So we sit down for an interview and we'll ask them tough questions about what they believe, and we'll expose their sort of hypocrisies. We'll put that to air. We'll put that on Four Corners. We'll put that on Triple J Live. I'm beating up on the ABC, but everyone's done it, right? They're just the most high-profile examples. But what that misunderstands is that older school approach is very out of step with what the people involved are hoping to get out. Academics for a long time who research this space are saying these groups that are fringe, like some of the views they hold and represent are actually quite common across the Australian community, but the groups themselves are very fringe. All they care about is getting their name and their ideology in front of millions of people. And once that is done, that is their job done. And in fact, the manual for one of these groups, a group called the National Socialist Network, which is a far-right group in Australia, which had some of its members now raided by the Australian Federal Police in ASIO investigations and is one of the more prominent groups, their manual, activist manual, was leaked to some journalists. I got my hands on it, and they have a huge section that says, our goal is just to get coverage. It doesn't matter how many tough questions the journalist asks, that just gets our name and our faces in front of millions of people, and maybe 1% of those people likes our ideas and they join our group. And that's how that group has had growth in the tens of thousands joining its social media networks in the last few months. So I think it's a really practical, I think, example of how there's a disconnect between what a previous generation of journalists think they're doing and I think what they're actually doing.
It's kind of infuriating too, because the work has been done on this. Like, it's not like this issue about reporting on extremism and the difficulties of it and the way that journalists and the media can be exploited in those situations is somehow brand new and just emerged because fascists got Twitter accounts. Like, the work has been done, there's endless academic work, and it's just a perpetual bugbear of mine that people in newsrooms have not read the really easy to read manuals that tell you how to best. I mean, it's a fraught space, of course, and you have to make hard decisions when trying to report on it, but the guides are there, and every time there's a new neo-Nazi on a evening news show and they are not interrogated and where they're not put in context, or they've just been put on live to share their views and answer questions as if the journalist will ask the question that ends neo-Nazism forever. is just infuriating.
I think it's, we need to acknowledge one thing though, just by way of background. I can remember in 1989, I was very young, I was about 10, I think. I interviewed a neo-Nazi over in Perth. There was a campaign of leafleting anti-Chinese, and we were pretty sure this organisation was behind it, and this guy was doing a failed run for local parliament. He got about 3 votes. And I went to his place and I sat down. I did a half-hour interview with him for Dateline at the time on SBS. We thought long and hard, and we finally decided that we were more likely to be giving him oxygen than reporting on anything meaningful, and so we shelved the interview and it never went to air. 2 years later, he got the notoriety he was looking for that he didn't get from SBS by us failing to give him his moment in the sun by carrying out a campaign of bombings of Chinese restaurants, and he was arrested and went to jail for 10 years. And I spent a long time wondering about whether the decision not to give him his little moment of joy made things better or made things worse, and we can never really know. It is complex. But we do have to acknowledge that we are all sitting here today talking as if the one aim of journalism is to do the best it can to deliver in the public interest for the audience and tell them what they need to know. The vast majority of media is trying to get eyeballs, trying to get attention and trying to get ratings. And it's terrible to say it, but neo-Nazis are a sexy topic. And I like to think no matter how much we try and justify it, an enormous amount of what goes on is driven by more base motives.
So you guys have been talking a lot about objective reporting and a lot about how in certain cases, like for instance the climate change debate, it's not reasonable to give both sides of the debate a voice, which I agree with. So why is it that during like elections you will give a voice to the Liberal and Labour Party when there's clearly like a better option and the facts are there with the Labour Party? If you look at, like, for instance, the GDP and things like that, but you still give equal time to both parties. Why is that?
Sounds like one for me to have a go at. Let me give climate change as an example. We do not allow at the ABC a debate over, or we try not to, on the basic ABC facts, on the basic facts of climate change. But if there is a debate about how quickly we should try and reach a certain reduction in emissions and what the alternatives are and whether there's still a role for coal, whether there's still a role for gas, there are all sorts of facts out there and views out there. Where there's still a live debate, I think it's legitimate to hear that. An election is an opportunity we have every few years to decide which party we think best represents our interests and we want to govern us. And there are many things we know about parties in Australia, and that is that at the moment, more people, the last election, once you do all the numbers, wanted the coalition than wanted the Labor. They were aware of all the policies. We see our job as journalists to a large extent of allowing those policies and those positions to be out there, to be given equal time so that you can make your decisions as a community about which set of responses to policy challenges appeal more. And I think that will always be a legitimate situation. Where you get tricky is the fringe groups. How much time do you give to Pauline Hanson? How much time do you give to those kinds of fringe views, and that is a challenge they always deal with. But I think fundamentally there is a need to say we need to allow that debate to happen within boundaries.
Reporters, newsrooms, outlets should not be deciding the outcomes of elections.
Rupert Murdoch would differ with you.
He has a different view, and it's a shame.
We haven't mentioned Trump, however, because in the last US election in November last year, in the lead up to that, US newsrooms and indeed international newsrooms were... it was a challenge to the norms, I suppose, the sort of deeply held traditions that are passed down about how to cover an election, you know, give both sides a run, equal time on air. But Trump lied repeatedly, and the newsrooms had to deal with taking him off air. I mean, that was an option that was used by some of the big networks, CNN, et cetera, in the United States. They simply turned him off when he started making false claims. I mean, I'm curious about whether Australian newsrooms would ever feel confident enough to make that call, because it's not as if elections are about a sober debate over policy every time.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. Like, I mean, Australian politicians lie as much as Trump does, and you will never, almost never see a headline on a mainstream news website that says, Morrison in lie claims blah. And I think the US media is way ahead of Australia on this. They have figured out that you can, of course, report on elections and not decide the outcome, but you can also call bullshit bullshit. In this country, journalists are very afraid of doing that with politicians. I think it's a shame. I'm starting to fire up now.
Yeah, now we've got 7 minutes of Oz's anger left. So, no.
I appreciate this discussion is about newsrooms rather than social media, but this morning at the breakfast session, there was a great discussion about the Facebook Arbitration Board, if that's the right name, or faux Supreme Court, some might say. Can we ever hope to see the transparency that we're talking about here? Is there any prospect that we might see that in these mega social media environments, or is that just an unrealistic dream?
You're the pro.
Can you fix that, Aaron?
I will do my best. Such a hard question. I think what was being mentioned there is an emerging entity called the Facebook Oversight Board, which was set up by Facebook last year. Ostensibly, it's meant to be an independent body that hard decisions about content. Say you have you made a post about politics in Australia, Facebook took it down, citing, say, the hate speech policy. You disagree with what they decided, you can try and refer your case up to the Oversight Board. And there's a lot of debate about whether this board is like a legitimate body, whether Facebook is sort of evading responsibility for content by creating this like sort of semi-random collection of international lawyers to refer these kinds of cases to. But yeah, I mean, we are begging and scrambling for scraps of transparency from companies like Twitter, Facebook, Google, YouTube when it comes to elections. I mean, the 2019 federal election, Facebook with great fanfare rolled out what they called their ad transparency platform. Ostensibly, it would tell you which on, say, a politician's Facebook page, all the ads they were running at that time, and that was it. I mean, in the United States, the journalists there got ad spend, ad targeting data. 2019 election, we did not have that at all. We could see the ads and make guesses about who was seeing them, but we actually had no idea. And that's why I was at the ABC at that time. We set up this hidden campaign project where we asked the public to send in what they were seeing. I mean, it was really the only way we could understand what kind of online advertising the ABC audience were seeing, whether it be Facebook ads, pre-roll ads on YouTube. There were ads appearing in like the kind of Google AdWord little box at the bottom of mobile gaming apps. Like, I mean, it was all Clive Palmer ads, let's be honest. But that was the only way, and that's the kind of transparency and the impact on our political system that we are begging from these companies, but yet to see.
I think there's a fundamental problem here, and I don't know how we fix it. Social media is meant to be the great, free, democratic, public marketplace of ideas where everyone could get on, but it belongs to big corporations. Where we choose to live, whether it be Twitter or Facebook, it is the privatisation of public space. It's like imagining that every street and every park in Sydney belong to Westfield, and they got to decide whether you're allowed to walk your dog on the rules around it. And that is the one fundamental structural problem that is really, really hard to fix.
We only have a short amount of time, so just in the interest of balance, if there are any questions from people who are not men, we'll take those now and then move back if we have time. But if anyone who's not a man wants to ask a question, the microphones are at the front.
Hi, I'm Rubina from Brisbane. I like to say that think that I read widely, and from that perspective, I just find the anti-China narrative, just the one narrative, non-nuanced, just the one narrative, really worrying. Whether it's Shorts Media, it's ABC, it's SBS, forget about the commercial channels. ABC rolls out ASPE all the time, and we know ASPE are compromised. We don't know where their funding comes from. More nuanced voices like academics like James Curran, Jeff Raby, former ambassador to China, who spent 30 years on the China desk here. Of course, our own Hugh White, Paul Keating. All these knowledgeable, experienced, researched voices are cautioning to have a more middle approach for Australia, rather than following the one American narrative, which is being, we all know where that's coming from. the CIA, and of course our own intelligence agencies. And I just find it just amazing why even channels like I don't see Lee Sales or Laura Tingle getting anyone apart from Aspie week after week after week, sure. Or Schwartz Media.
Can I jump in? I think you make a perfectly valid point, and it almost follows on from the point I made before. If you believe some of the emerging rhetoric coming out of our leaders at the moment, we're heading onto a war footing against China. And like you, I think you make a valid point that these are the times that are most dangerous for journalism. There is a dominant paradigm. Everyone can see all the terrible things that the Chinese totalitarian regime is doing. They're being pushed very strongly. And it's not untrue, those elements, and yet you can see a dominant narrative emerging. And there is no doubt that this is a great example of where the media needs to look for opportunities to be sometimes an uncomfortable voice, and it goes back to speaking truth to power, to know when you need to challenge that narrative and find a diversity of views. And it's very much a work in progress.
And also, do you think this particular issue would be different if there were more Chinese journalists in Australian newsrooms?
Yeah, I think no question. I mean, I think everything Alan said is right. It obviously, obviously dominant narratives shape, like, when it comes to foreign policy in particular, Australian media tends to take the establishment line, I think. That's kind of the case. And I think on China, there is very clearly an establishment line. We were talking earlier about how China can be held, like should be held responsible for terrible crimes committed, particularly against the Uyghur population, but also having our senior public officials say that the march, the drums of war are beating is obviously also disastrous. I don't think that that big picture issue is just fixed by having more Chinese-Australian journalists. I think that's a separate issue. But I do think the part of the problem is whenever we talk about these topics, whether it's China, whether it's the end of the war in Afghanistan, it's always done through a lens of politics and foreign policy, and it's not on it. Like, you very rarely see Chinese Australians interviewed about their lives and the complexities of their lives, but when there's conflict that seems to be getting closer, we're like, what do you think about Australia invading China? What do you think about these issues? I think it's very reductive.
And what stories get told too? I mean, we can, if we think about the past week, we heard Peter Dutton, that was widely reported, his comments about China and Taiwan, and then we had stories from Michael Pizzullo, about Michael Pizzullo, the head of Home Affairs, and that's the drums are beating, no?
Drums
or
beating.
This once again comes back to the question of which stories are getting told. Do we need to cover the head of Home Affairs' comments on this, which was an internal speech that obviously somebody was keen for their media to report on? I mean, these are the questions that come back to the newsroom topics too. Is everything that the head of Home Affairs says necessarily newsworthy? These are like the kind of base questions that we come back to when we're examining which stories get told and how those stories reflect power in Australian media and politics.
I think that's a really terrific place to end. Ariel, Oz, Alan, thank you so much for this. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you to the Judith Nielsen Institute for sponsoring the session and to the Sydney Writers Festival for putting it on.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.